this plea, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. Impont Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Alberelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Alberelli then made the link with the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps. Notably, horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved, and afterwards the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came into this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made. And if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't. And so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out. Therefore, we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont-Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain, or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont-Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont sent his plea, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States. And they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
Robbena, Robbena.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Today we're going to be looking at a very important question regarding the subject of the unity of God's Lordship. And that question is this: We know when we examine some of the verses of the Holy Quran and also the history of the Arabian Peninsula that at the time of the descent of the Holy Quran and the genesis of the Islamic religion, that the pagan Arabs who lived at that time, they were of the belief that although God is the creator of the entire universe, and he's the sole being who's created anything that exists in this universe and in the realm of existence, after creating these beings that exist in this universe, God Almighty handed over the affairs and the regulation and overseeing of the beings that exist in this universe to a series of demigods. For example, they said that there's one god or there's one demigod whose responsibility is to regulate the affairs of man. There's another one whose responsibility is to oversee the affairs of a certain animal. There's one whose responsibility it is to oversee the affairs of weather, and so on and so forth. The question that we want to pose today is this. If these demigods, and these are obviously a series of immaterial and transcendent beings over and above the material realm, the question arises as to why would the pagan Arabs then worship, make idols out of stones and wood, and history tells us they even made idols out of dates and so on, and worship them. Why wouldn't they worship these demigods? What's the secret behind this? The answer, because obviously it doesn't make sense for us to say that these people made these idols out of these materials and worshiped them, because they believed that these idols themselves were the regulators and overseers of the affairs of the universe. No human being could be so ignorant as to say that. The answer to this question, as some of our scholars have mentioned, is this, that these people, yes, they believed that these transcendent beings were the demigods whose responsibility it was to oversee the affairs of the universe. Nevertheless, there was an assumption in their mind, and that was this, that because these beings were things that were incapable of being sensed and outside of the jurisdiction of man's knowledge, meaning man didn't have the ability to understand them and observe them and orient his heart and his mind towards them, therefore it would be therefore necessary for man to create images out of stones or to depict images on paper or on cloth and so on and so forth. So it would be as manifestations of those beings, so that man could orient himself towards these manifestations of those beings and via them and through their medium worship those beings. This was the reason why these polytheists took recourse to idolatry, and this is how it came about and the fundamental reasoning behind it. Of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that this belief was right or this action was correct. It's fundamentally wrong, because we are of the opinion that God is essentially the Lord of all creation, and not any demigod or other being which he might have handed over the affairs of the universe to. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the problem of God's lordship. Until next time, assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to have a share of a few moments of your day as we reflect upon the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in the form of everyday stories, stories regarding great personalities and figures, anecdotes, analogies. Because at the end of the day, we do what we can in order to find a glimpse of the light of truth in our lives. The story we're going to be discussing today is very similar to that of Nabi Ayyub alayhi salam, which we've talked about on our show, I think, on several occasions. So let's listen to the story real quick, and we'll see how this story is similar to that of the Prophet of God.
In the name of Allah, dear friends, so welcome to this program, Lantern. Today's story is entitled Feeling Pleased with Whatever Pleases Allah. One of the students of Sheikh Behjat, the great scholar, says, "One day I went to the house of Sheikh Behjat a few minutes before the start of the class because often the Sheikh used to attend the classroom. And he would narrate a story or a tradition or a moral lesson till all the students attend. Luckily, as I entered, he came to the room early and said this to me after the greeting and the salutation. In the city of Najaf, a handsome Iranian youth was with us from the people of Hamadan, and he was famous for being neat and physically well-formed. One day, this youth became paralyzed to the extent he could not walk except after leaning on a cane. I tried not to meet him due to his particular condition. Therefore, I used to avoid meeting him so I would not add one more grief to his griefs. One day, I got out of the alley and saw him standing in the street, so I had no choice except to meet him. Without contemplating, I asked him, 'How do you feel?' But I was upset with having said so and kept saying this to myself, 'What empty talk is this? Do you not see in what condition he is?' But contrary to my expectation, when he opened his mouth to answer my question, his speech was like cool water with which he put out what I had felt inside. He kept praising and thanking Allah with a spirit filled with activity and pleasure, as if he was drowned in blessings of Allah, the praised and the most exalted one. I felt relieved, and my grief departed from me."
the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The story was regarding Ayatollah Behjet. Now, I don't personally know about the trials and turbulences and obstacles and difficulties Ayatollah Behjet went through in his life, though I'm pretty sure they weren't little, because anyone who gets anywhere in life has gotten through that, has gotten there through trials and tests from Allah. And it is through those trials and tests that a man's true measure is revealed, and for ourselves most and foremost, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala already knows the quality of his servants and what they're made of, the extent of their spirit, their capacity. But if he does put us through tests, the tests are so that we prove something to ourselves, whether we can power through a certain situation, whether we can fight the obstacles, we can fight those battles, and we can stand tall at the end and step out of that storm as a better person. It all comes down to how we weather the storms of life. So the story was about a man who was known among his peers and his classmates as being very well dressed and, you know, being handsome and good looking and whatever. Some people are like that. Aside from being well dressed, you know, they have that thing going on with their natural appearance that is attractive, that looks, everything looks so well proportioned. And he was one of those individuals. And his test, ironically or naturally enough, was that he would be paralyzed, and which is something that we really need to focus on at some point as well. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, it seems that you get what you hate. That's what we usually talk. That's how we see it as, you know, simple-minded human beings. But from Allah's perspective, not that I am a professional at understanding Allah's perspective, but from what it seems is that you really do get what you hate, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants you to grow out of that. We are so keen on remaining in our comfort zones, but what we don't understand is that, as cliche as it may sound, unless we step out of that comfort zone, there is not going to be any growth for us. A child who learns how to ride the bike for the first time isn't feeling comfortable. A child who is weaned from his mother's, their mother's breast milk isn't comfortable. A child who is potty training isn't comfortable. I'm not comparing ourselves to a toddler, but I kind of am, because the foundation of our growth is set from our childhood. And by putting us through that process, it's like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to tell us that this is the condition to your growth. You have to step out of your comfort zone. You have to experiment things that you didn't even imagine you could do. A child cannot imagine themselves not living a single day without their mother's milk, or without being able to go potty anywhere, anytime. The process of having to step into another room to do their business is so alien to them. When we grow up, sure, our lives become much, 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 like a million times more complicated than the process of, you know, call of nature. But the idea, the system is still the same, even if the scenario changes. So basically, through blessings, Allah wants to, just a quick wrap up, He wants us to grow. He wants us to get out of our comfort zone. He wants to encourage and motivate us. And He wants to raise awareness and consciousness within us through each blessing. Each blessing is a sign that is meant to lead us somewhere. And it is important for us to recognize what that sign is pointing toward. That's all the time that we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Africa Today.
Nigeria, a country facing widespread violence. On the fifth anniversary of the Zaria massacre, many Muslims are still struggling for their rights. The massacre took place in Zaria, Kaduna State, in 2015. After a brutal attack by the Nigerian army, at least 348 civilians were killed. That's according to official tally. And 347 bodies were secretly buried. Welcome to Africa Today. I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya. In this episode, we look at the massacre, asking whether those responsible have been held accountable after 5 years. Apart from that, we delve into Nigeria's quest to end police brutality as the country continues suffering from terror attacks by Takfiri terrorists. Stay tuned.
Zaria massacre. Those killed in Zaria during the notable human rights violation in mid-December 2015 were mostly members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Top Shia cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki was arrested along with his wife Mualima Zina, and many are blaming Saudi Arabia for funding the massacre. The victims were unarmed protesters, and human rights organizations have asserted that the violent crackdown, which continued for 3 days, was carried out without any provocation.
A commission of inquiry inside Nigeria also called for prosecution of all those involved in the killings. Yet, years later, justice is yet to be served. Our first guest is Mr. Masoud Shajare, human rights campaigner at the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Mr. Shajare, welcome to our program. On the fifth anniversary of the massacre, how much do we know about what actually happened on that day?
Well, part of the truth have come out already, even in their own investigation, which was set up almost a year after the massacre. It was a number of things came up. One was the fact that, according to them, over 400 people were massacred, but we've got the actual figure, it was just under 1,000. And they also admitted that they have big mass graves, and many people have been buried in those mass graves.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, in the studio, we are also joined by Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, who will elaborate to us on the situation. Hello, Mr. Abdullahi, and welcome to our program. Now, for a start, can you tell us exactly what is the situation of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, who've been incarcerated now for almost, actually, 5 years?
Yes, the situation is still worse. That is, they were in a worse health condition because there is no appropriate medical attention given to them. And for the Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, recent analysis or recent investigation revealed that he has about 55 foreign body shrapnels, bullet shrapnels in his body.
Not removed yet, yeah?
Yes, none has been removed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he complained of some pain from his head downwards. Mm-hmm. And it was said that they must be removed before he can have his health been improved.
Now, thank you, Mr. Abdullahi, for that elaboration. And stay tuned for more.
The details of the massacre of hundreds of men, women, and children by soldiers in Zaria are gruesome. Some were injured and burned alive, and the bodies of those killed were left littered in the streets. The arrest and prosecution of the military officers involved in the crackdown is part of the movement's quest for justice, which is yet to materialize.
Let us not forget, 5 working days a week, Nigerian Islamic movement and its supporters come in the street in Abuja and other cities, every single working days. And they've been shot at, they have been gassed, they have been killed, they have been arrested, they have been tortured, but it hasn't stopped.
The Islamic movement of Nigeria has been a target of the Nigerian government's heavy-handed crackdown from the get-go. The members' peaceful protests are suppressed by military forces, as the Nigerian government has banned them as terrorists and detained their leader.
I just hope that we will continue to protest until they let us have contact with them, not show us pictures or give statements in press conferences. They should let us see them. If they don't let us see them, then we don't know that if they're healthy or not. We just know what they tell us. So hopefully the protests are peaceful and that we're not attacking anybody. We're just peacefully protesting that we want to see them and we want to make sure that they're alive. And they're alive and they're getting treatment. And until they allow us to see them, we're not going to trust whatever is it that they say.
Back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. A court, a Nigerian court actually, in Kaduna, has ordered the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, but the government is adamant on continuing to detain him. Is the judiciary really independent in Nigeria?
Well, we cannot say yes, because if they're independent, the order given must have been complied with. But it seems that they were not independent. And we have seen a lot of things where the court has given an order and it was not being complied by the
government.
Yes, it's not by the government. So we cannot say they are defendant, although we are expecting justice from them in the court.
Thank you. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria has demanded the freedom of their leader through protests staged across Nigeria, including protests in the capital, Abuja. Defying the ban, the Islamic movement is alive and resolute in its demand for the freedom of Sheikh Zakzaki. The Muslim leader is indeed an emblem of resistance against injustice in the Islamic world today.
I don't think the power of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, and indeed their commitment, could be destroyed by these tactics. If anything, Islamic movement in Nigeria is now more prominent, and indeed many more people in Nigeria see them as a legitimate opposition against corruption, against this sort of dictatorship, and they actually have become more people have become more supportive towards them.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, many members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria are still missing, since the massacre in Zaria in 2015 and throughout the years. Now, what is their fate, actually? Do you know, is there any investigation going on? Are there efforts to, find them?
Well, in fact, we don't have any news, information about them, because we cannot investigate. Though we thought that we are thinking that they were in some detention facilities in some army barracks, but we don't have categorically an information on that.
And is there a way you can follow up through government agencies?
No, there's none. Mm-hmm. There's none, but we hope later.
Thank you for that, and stay tuned for more.
In the 5th anniversary of the crimes, those who lost their loved ones are still far from witnessing justice. Zaria has remained an epicenter for the government attempt to disrupt the movement's religious practices. Even peaceful protests are met harshly and trigger massive crackdown. The loss of lives, meanwhile, has been a source of concern not just for the victims' Muslim brothers across the world, but also human rights organizations. This is while there are reports that the Saudi monarchy has been behind the massive crackdown on the movement. In order to promote Wahhabi doctrine, Riyadh is known to fund Salafist initiatives across the Muslim world and beyond.
There was a WikiLeaks document that showed that the Saudi embassies were putting pressure on Nigeria to tackle the ever-growing popularity of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, but also the officials, including the MBS, the prince, have actually said that we have tackled Iran's influence in Africa and Nigeria. And it's very clear that they are involved, they are financing these massacres.
Now, back to the studio with our guest, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, do you think that foreign entities or governments are involved, actually, in the persecution of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria?
Yes, they were really involved, directly and indirectly.
Okay.
The first evidence of their involvement was that immediately after the carnage, there was some information that we had that from one newspaper, American Times, mm-hmm. that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has said that they have reduced the influence of Iran in Nigeria mm-hmm. By attacking the Islamic movement. This is one of the example of the involvement of foreign entities. Yes. And also recently there were some reports that there were some software that was sold to Nigerian government mm-hmm. whereby they can easily track the pulse of people.
From which company?
I'm not very sure about
it. Or from which country or state?
Unfortunately, I cannot remember that.
Because mm-hmm. there were reports that an Israeli company has sold some spy software to the Nigerian government.
Yes, exactly. It's the same report.
Yeah.
Okay. So another thing also is that there is congratulation made by mm-hmm. the same person, that is the Prince of the Saudi
Prince
Arabia.
Prince Salman.
Yes, Prince Salman. He said that he's congratulating the Nigerian government that they have met some war against terrorism mm-hmm. at the time they attack the Islamic movement. So this and the many other examples were evidences that indicate that there were involvement of foreign entities. Another thing, again, is the silence mm-hmm. of the main media. For example, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. In fact, when something less than that happens, they normally broadcast it immediately. Yeah. But this one, they don't broadcast
They've given it.
It
a blackout.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this one. And another thing is that there are a lot of things that happen and they intervene.
Yeah.
For example, the bell of Sambo Dasuki, that is a security advisor to the Jonathan.
Yeah.
They just intervened and he was released.
Yeah.
And this is an indication that their silence is an approval of what has been done to Islamic movement. So these are some of the examples.
Thanks for that. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria simply wants the government to do the right thing. The Nigerian government and the military target the Islamic movement while senseless violence and insecurity caused by the likes of Boko Haram remain to be addressed.
A few years after, you could see by 2010, 2011, when the bombings and the attacks started, you know, there was this, I would say, very slow reaction to understanding how deep a threat this was. And then you see by 2013, 2014, the attacks got really, really massive, and it blew on our faces when, you know, there was that Chibok incident when, you know, young girls were, over 200 girls were taken, you know, from school. So if you see why the government started building capacity, acquiring weapons, which they hadn't done for many years, and weapons that actually fit into the theater and the threat that they face, you could see that they started making gains.
Farmers are beheaded, schools are attacked, and bandits raid people's homes. The Islamic movement in Nigeria argues that the reason for the failure to address Takfiri militancy or terrorism is the government's dysfunctional system. The military forces appear to be only capable of suppressing peaceful dissent rather than taking on actual criminals. So are the protests effective?
Well, it's extremely effective. I mean, you give me another place around the world that's 5 years with all these brutality, still people come out, still the standoff. People have, you know, given members of their family, not one or two.
Thank you for that, Mr. Masoud Shajare of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. Now, back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. Now, Sheikh Zakzaki has been away, imprisoned for 5 years now. Now, how is the Islamic movement coping with his absence? Is it still continuing with its activities?
Yes, although it is disheartening, yeah, the loss of the leader of that kind. However, before he told us that we should continue with what we are doing.
Yeah.
And even before that, he has trained us that not only all things will come from him. We have, yeah, to have our initiatives.
Yeah.
So all things, all the programs that we accustom, they are progressing. None has stopped.
Oh,
therefore, mm-hmm, we cope with that.
So there's no vacuum.
No, there's no vacuum.
Okay, now, as the Islamic movement in Nigeria, are you collaborating with other human rights organizations and civil rights groups in demanding or in pressurizing the Nigerian government to release Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, and also to probe other incidents of persecution of members of the movement?
Yes, there are a lot. All well-meaning people,
yeah,
must be sided with the oppressed.
Yeah.
So we have some civil organizations such as the organization headed by Deji,
okay,
Adeyanju.
Okay.
That is called Nigerian Concern Groups.
Very
That's
good.
Nigerian Concern Group is, mm, really, we are really working together.
Yeah.
They are involved in our activities of Free Zakzaki campaign.
Yeah.
And most of them were Christians. Most, mm-hmm, of them are Christian,
That's
but today we are together.
Yeah.
We are together. And there were individuals also, mm-hmm, that were normally, you know, they were against the operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot.
Oh, thank you for that, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, for joining us today to discuss about the state of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and the continued illegal incarceration of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. We are looking forward to his release, and that the calls for Free Zakzaki will be listened by the Nigerian government, and he will be released and go back to serve the people and actually the whole society in Nigeria, because I believe he was serving the whole society in Nigeria regardless of religion or sect. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you so much.
And thank you for watching.
End SARS protests.
Youths in Nigeria are fed up with the way police forces treat innocent people. The social movement against police brutality and extortion initially called for the disbanding of the Special Robbery Squad, SARS. The notorious unit of the Nigerian police has a long record of abuses. But instead of addressing crimes like armed robbery and kidnappings, the forces resorted to human rights violations, extrajudicial killings, sexual harassment of women, and brutalizing young people.
A couple of Nigerian youths are in the hospital currently in pains, suffering from results of stray bullets shot directly to unarmed protesters.
The bad record by these Nigerian police unit triggered peaceful protests in 2017 that continue to this day, although the government has resorted to a myriad of tactics to derail the movement. But what are the movement's demands, and are they within reach? We invited author and journalist Eric Welberg to share his view. Mr. Welberg, what's your take?
The primary demand is to release all the protesters that have been jailed, and also they want justice. They want compensation for those that were harmed and injured and killed, some of them during protests. They also want an investigation. They asked, they demanded a panel that would investigate the police actions, police brutality. And interestingly enough, they also asked for an increase in police salaries with the idea to reduce their reliance on bribery and to also make them more accountable for their actions.
SARS has been known for regularly detaining young male Nigerians illegally and extorting money from their relatives. Public outcry returned to social media when video showing a SARS police officer shooting a young Nigerian in front of a hotel went viral in October 2020. The forces have also been accused of widespread torture, mock executions, and other forms of physical and mental abuses. The reform and reorganization of SARS by the government has not only failed to bring an end to the demonstrations, but also infuriated activists across the country, yielding a new phase of the movement.
I think that they have a good possibility of reform because it's they're strong. They've got 100 years of tradition. The first big demonstrations of Nigerian women were in 1929, and it was against colonial attempts to squeeze market women, of course, dominating the market in Nigeria, and the British colonial government tried to siphon off more money from them.
Protests that swept the country in October against police brutality appear to be coming back. Among the protesters' top demands are the release of all those arrested in the peaceful protests. They are also seeking justice and compensation for all those who lost their lives due to police brutality.
Well, this protest against police brutality, the big place where that's happening is in the United States, but also in Britain, in Europe, in France, there are a lot of protests of police brutality. So I think there is a general groundswell of anger, and these women have really pushed to the forefront in protesting police brutality in Nigeria. So that's a good sign, but they're very angry. They had the same promises in 2017 and 2018, so nothing really seemed to have happened. So I don't know if this time they will succeed.
Now, the movement that started as an effort to reform police now looks like the beginning of a youth awakening in Nigeria. Women are also playing a key role in the movement as diverse communities unite behind one goal to form the backbone of the End SARS protests.
We're here because we believe in what we're fighting for. We are firm to it. And, you know, if you listen to our national anthem and our national pledge, we are here to defend our unity.
We are fighting for the truth. We are fighting for the labor of our heroes' past. We don't want it to be in vain.
I prefer to die well for my children to have a better tomorrow. The truth is it.
There have been lots of graphic footage showing police and army officers shooting and abusing protesters. The activists are now wary of bad governance involving vows to investigate killings while simultaneously discrediting reports of abuses. There are meanwhile efforts underway to organize a network of lawyers to provide free legal support to protesters and victims of police abuses across the country. That's the end of today's program. We hope to see Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife out of prison to join their family, friends, and companions. And we wish peace and prosperity for the people of Nigeria. Goodbye for now, and God bless you all.